Bibi Fahodie, welcome to the African Liberation Media Podcast. Media solely focused on the liberation and empowerment of African people. I'm your host, Gullah Jack, a.k.a. Russell Swilly. Let's get to it. Good evening. Brief note, the Justice Department has closed the investigation into the Emmett Till killing after failing to prove that key witnesses lied. Carolyn Bryant Dunham, the principal figure in this case, in this saga, denied to investigators that she had recanted her story or her testimony. Secondly and finally, justice for Ahmaud Arbery has not been finalized. Jackie Johnson, as we know, has been indicted for covering up the murder of young Aubrey. But the Waycross DA, George Barnhill, took over the case when Johnson recused herself. Barnhill obstructed the arrest of the murderers by writing a letter justifying the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. The day's date is December 6th, 6261. This is the African Liberation Media. I'm here with a special guest, Brother Fasil Chirinet, Tahira, Ahmaud, and Makaru. This is the African Liberation Media. Go ahead, gentlemen.
Abargani, African family. We do indeed have a very special guest. As many people who have listened to our previous podcast know, we've been focused on the conflict in Ethiopia because we consider it to be perhaps the most critical international event affecting African people on this planet. At this particular time. So I reached out to my good brother, Dr. Kelly Harris, professor of Africana Studies, the director of Africana Studies at Seton Hall. He contacted one of his comrades that he went to grad school with at Clark Atlanta, Dr. Kurt Young, and they put us in contact with our guest tonight, Brother Fasil Chirinet. And we'll introduce him further in just a moment. But in keeping with one of the things that we're trying to do in terms of current events, Sister Tahira has just one brief reminder for us, something to keep aware of, and then we'll go into the main focus of our program tonight, which is the conflict, the crisis in Ethiopia.
Asante Sana. Yes, very briefly, we will go into this further next week. But after the Rittenhouse verdict, protesters in Kenosha and social media users are calling for justice for Crystal Kizer. Kizer was 16 years old when she met the perverted 33-year-old Randy Volar on Backpage.com in 2016. He sexually abused and trafficked her for almost 2 years. He did the same to several other young Black girls, and finally in February 2018, police arrested him for child enticement, a use of a computer to facilitate a child sex crime, and second-degree sexual assault of a child. He was released the same day and without bail. During their investigation, police found hundreds of child pornography videos and more than 20 home videos of Valar with underage Black girls. The police also had a statement from a 15-year-old Black girl who told them that she had been abused by Volar since she was 14. Basically, in releasing him, they gave him the green light to continue to traffic and abuse poor young Black girls for a little more than 3 months. And then finally, in June 2018, Crystal Kizer shot Valar 2 times in the head, set him and his house on fire, and drove off with his BMW. the same district attorney whose office knew about the charges against Villar and had evidence against him, but took their time prosecuting him, charged Crystal with arson and first-degree intentional homicide, among other felony charges. Prosecutors are saying it was premeditated, while Crystal maintains that it was self-defense. Her lawyers have entered an affirmative defense plea, which per Wisconsin statute states a victim of a violation of trafficking has an affirmative defense for any offense committed as a direct result of the violation of trafficking without regard to whether anyone was prosecuted or convicted for the violation of trafficking. Prosecutors have argued against that plea. A trial court, in fact, denied the plea, but in June of this year, an appellate court reversed that decision and sent the case back to the trial level. Thanks to various community organizations and donors, Crystal is currently out on a $400,000 bond, which was originally set at $1 million. So protesters are arguing that if 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse can go to Kenosha and shoot three men, killing two, with an assault rifle that was purchased by his friend and claim self-defense successfully, then a 17-year-old Crystal Kaiser should be able to defend herself against her abuser. I agree with her. I mean, are we really supposed to believe that an untrained 17-year-old traveled to another state to walk around with an unloaded assault rifle during a volatile time to make new friends? Or was he there to terrorize the community? I'll let you guys have it.
Asante Sana Tahira. Yeah, we will go into the Crystal Kaiser case. Of course, it reminds many of us who know the history of the case of Joanne Little here in North Carolina, repeatedly raped by a prison guard, and she engaged in affirmative action and took him off the planet. That became a big case during the 1970s. And then, of course, you could go all the way back to the case of Celia versus the slave state of Missouri in the 1850s, an enslaved young African woman who was repeatedly raped and impregnated by an enslaver whom she ultimately killed. And she was tried also. So those cases remind us of that. And we have to always stand in defense of our women, because without our sisters, you know, there are no African people. For today's topic, Ethiopia, the current situation, the crisis that has erupted since particularly since November of 2020, for over a year now. We reached out and were able to contact our brother, Facile Sherinette, Dr. Facile Sherinette, who is a native of Ethiopia, graduated from Addis Ababa University before coming to the U.S. to continue his education, where he received a master's degree in international studies and development from Clark Atlanta University and a Ph.D. in political science from Clark Atlanta, and now teaches political science at Georgia State University, the Perimeter College of Georgia State, and is very active in the Ethiopian community in the Atlanta area and in the U.S. and in the world. So welcome to the show, my good brother.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for the opportunity to speak on this important issue that is not only important for Ethiopia, but also across the continent for the African-American community and the diaspora at large. So, yes, thank you. But also, this is an important forum. Just the few minutes that I am on this forum, I heard those two important issues. And I really appreciate the fact that you're creating this platform, hosting discussions that matters to us as Black people. Thank you.
Asante Sana, good brother. In terms of in terms of the history that has led to this particular moment, of course, our brother Amos has traveled to Ethiopia, and we were very, very, you know, inspired by the election in 2018 of Abiy Ahmed and the reforms that he instituted, the peace treaty with Eritrea. And, you know, it was just a very positive development. But we know our enemies are always looking to destabilize and undermine anything positive that African people do. I mean, this is really our history. It's a history of being taken out of our development by our historical enemies and, you know, becoming a footnote in their history if they would, you know, have their way. In terms of this history, do you want to begin with, I don't know how far you want to, do you want to begin with the overthrow of Haile Selassie and the Marxist regime that came to power, which was then replaced by the TPLF? Would you like to begin there, or would you want...
Sure.
Go ahead then.
Okay, yes. The Emperor Haile Selassie was in power for more than 40 years. And in 1974, there was an uprising and a movement because the system was not adapting to changing events in the country, was not able to reform the land tenure system. For that and many other reasons, the student movement helped the overthrow of the emperor. So at that point, the military was the only organized institution that assumed power and eventually was, of course, radicalized by the student movement and continued to rule the country based on Ethiopian socialism. At the time, 1974 was also a very critical time for Ethiopia. There was an invasion from Somalia, which also brought in the two superpowers into the region. The United States at the time under the Carter administration refused to deliver weapons that have already been paid for, impounded them, and we were not able to defend ourselves as a country and repel the Somali invasion. So that led Ethiopia to seek help from the Soviet Union, which airlifted billions of dollars of weapons. And then, of course, the aggression was repelled. Since then, the military was ruling the country based on it was sort of a military dictatorship. So in 1975, the TPLF was founded, the Tigrayan People Liberation Front, an insurgent group, and it ousted the military regime in 1991. Of course, the U.S. was also one of the facilitators of the peace talk that took place in London and was supportive of the fact that the TPLF was moving into Addis and taking over the government. Once it came to power, it also created a coalition, just to give the impression that this is a broad-based system, but actually this was not a partnership among equals. So it brought in four more groups into the coalition and started ruling as being the strongest of all the coalition forces. So the TPLF, since it came to power, was ruling with an iron fist. It also... The first thing it did was develop a constitution that divided the country based on ethnic federalism. So now that's a very important development because what it has essentially do was it came at the expense of the already built Ethiopian identity and then created these ethnic enclaves where each subnational government was, so to speak, serving as its own agent, an agent of its own community, and then that has a very disintegrative political and economic role. Ethnic boundaries prior to that arrangement was very fluid. People intermarried, interacted, even if they have these disagreements, they used community mechanisms to solve those. But once this ethnic identity was defined, it was actually redefined in such a way that it creates division among the major ethnic groups. That came also at the expense of Ethiopian national identity. So that helped this TPLF government to rule over the country without any tolerance for dissent and basically building up its own elite oligarchy, so to speak, because the TPLF didn't even benefit the Tigray people in its region. Right now, as we speak, 1.5 million Tigrayans are living under government subsidy, even before the war started. So this tells you that it was an oligarchy that was only working for the group's interest. So it created an economic elite. It took over the civil service and also looted about $30 billion from the country, according to Forbes magazine in 2014. And all of that kind of created a very strong, deeply rooted group that was ruling the country. And then in 2018, you have the reform movement from within the EPRDF, Ethiopian Revolutionary Democratic Forces, the ruling government, which was also supported by a popular uprising in the Oromo and Amara region. So Dr. Abiy's government came to the scene, and then immediately it started to democratize the political system and initiate reconciliation, as you have mentioned earlier, released political prisoners without any precondition, started creating independent institutions, the election board, the judiciary, so on and so forth. It also invited exiled opposition groups, including those that have adopted armed opposition as a means, so that they can come and participate in the newly created political space. Regionally, the reform government made a peace deal with Eritrea, formally ending the conflict and restoring diplomatic relations with neighboring Eritrea. So ever since its ousting, the TPLF had been defiant and working tirelessly to sabotage the reform movement, sponsoring and instigating ethnic violence in Benishangul and Oromo region, defying the federal government and conducting an election. Last year, as you have mentioned, around this time, it preemptively attacked the federal forces stationed in the north part of Tigray. So even after the government declared unilateral ceasefire, the TPLF saw that as a weakness and an opportunity to regroup and take the destruction into the neighboring Amara and Afar regions. So all of these events are a testimony to what the TPLF is as an organization. So within this, the United States immediately exploited the TPLF provoked conflict with Ethiopia. And from day one, the Biden administration began portraying the TPLF as a victim of the crisis, even though the TPLF essentially was responsible for insurrection. But it portrayed it as a victim and of state-sponsored genocide, portraying the war, instead of a law enforcement operation, as a war directed on the people of Tigray. State Department press release supporting the TPLF, which is also a group that is designated as a terrorist group by the U.S. government previously, as well as the Ethiopian parliament. Regardless, the U.S. government continued to support, suspend economic aid, impose travel restrictions on the leadership of the reform government, and also threatened now to delist Ethiopia from the African Growth Opportunity Act, effective January. So the U.S. also failed to recognize the first free and fair election, in which 75% of the population voted to elect the current prime minister. No comments or press releases were given that were encouraging this fledgling democracy. So rather, the U.S. about 3 weeks ago also supported a coalition government of sort, which was facilitated by the TPLF in the Washington, D.C. area, formally establishing an exile government, so to speak. The Senate and the House also continue to pass resolutions after resolutions, and there are a couple of bills that are being discussed and in the pipeline now to put more restrictions regardless of the changing conditions on the ground. They're trying to impose more and more financial restrictions and depriving Ethiopia of much needed access to the international finance. The United States also presented this issue to the UN Security Council 13 times and wanted to get an approval of sort under to intervene militarily or do some other extra measures under the auspices of the United Nations Security Council. So that didn't go through. And very recently, there's this concerted effort to ban or take out of social media pro-Ethiopian forces, individuals, and groups that are fighting this corporate media misinformation and disinformation about Ethiopia. To give you an example, about a month ago, the prime minister made a call to the Ethiopian population to come and unite and fight this terrorist group. So that was also taken off Facebook under the pretext of inciting violence. Facebook, Twitter have also been doing a lot of, they've been imposing a lot of restrictions on forces that are working to put the cause, the right cause, and the facts and the truths to the international community using social media and so on and so forth. So one would wonder that there you have a government with a track record of doing all the good stuff and also won the Nobel Peace Prize. And then you see the United States supporting a terrorist group that has been known to be a terrorist group for a long time and continue to act like that and behave like that. So one of the reasons that I can think of is American policy is driven by its geopolitical chess game with China in that Red Sea region. Also, the United States doesn't like Ethiopia's effort to be independent and self-reliant. This is going to be a very bad example to the rest of the continent because the government of Ethiopia, for the first time, was able to successfully complete the Great Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, for example, without any financial aid from the Western financial institutions. So now that dam is also said to be making Ethiopia a middle-income country by 2025. 60 million people will also be getting access to electric power. So it's a game changer, but of course the U.S. has a much more important ally in Egypt and doesn't want that to be facilitated and helping the Ethiopian people. So the U.S. is also, I believe, more concerned about its ally Egypt, as I've said, which has interest on the Nile River. The other factor would be TPLF has a long-term personal relationship with people that are placed in high places in this administration right now and are behind this policy, misinformed policy, and also trying to disintegrate the country, intervene under the pretext of humanitarian emergency. So all of these are the factors that are of concern, of course, to all progressive forces. And the fight continues. The government has now rerouted the TPLF out of most areas that it has been occupying. And Ethiopian people are rallying behind this government, despite the misinformation and hybrid war that is waged on Ethiopia. So to give you an example of this misinformation that was meant to be creating mass hysteria in Ethiopia, CNN came up with a fake news, photoshopping a photograph that was taken 8 years ago and telling the international community that the rebels are right at the vicinity of the capital. So we need to evacuate, and the American embassy was helping with that narrative, whereas the fact on the grounds were totally different. CNN and the mainstream media, corporate media, haven't been willing to entertain the other perspectives on this issue so that people can get a balanced understanding of what's going on. Because they're kind of endorsing and supporting and facilitating U.S. foreign policy. Thank you.
Brother Facile, you gave us a lot of information, a lot of good information there. And I'm definitely sure that our listeners are enjoying what they're hearing. A question that I have for you is oftentimes the U.S. media or the Western media will try to vilify a leader that they don't agree with. From your perspective as an Ethiopian, What is the opinion of the majority of the people in Ethiopia of the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed?
Thank you. Well, as I've said earlier, 75% of eligible voters voted for him. And also there were a series of peaceful protests in the capital and other parts of the country. This pressure has united the Ethiopian people behind the Prime Minister. I'm not saying that the Prime Minister is doing everything right, but at least he's legitimately elected. As any other government, there are things that you'll be held responsible for not doing right. But at the end of the day, he is elected. The Ethiopian people have spoken. And the international community must honor the will of the Ethiopian people. Right now, there is a challenge put out by the government to bring 1 million Ethiopian diaspora into Ethiopia by the Ethiopian Christmas, which is January 7th, according to the Ethiopian calendar. So that is also a show of support. Right now, if you call the Ethiopian Airlines, the flights are booked all the way, and people are just getting ready. This is all to dispel this misinformation that was being spread by the U.S. Embassy about Addis Ababa not being very peaceful and very risky for people to stay there, and they have to leave. So that's one sign that the people are right behind the Prime Minister and his government. People are volunteering to do whatever is possible in terms of helping with this effort domestically, as well as nationally. The diaspora community is mobilized like ever before.
Okay, yeah, and indeed, as Brother Amo said, you gave us a lot to unpack there. And for people who may not be familiar with the history, I want to go back in terms of the geopolitics. Of course, the U.S., we know, only operates in its interest. It has no permanent friends or enemies, for that matter. It only has permanent interest. And if we go back to 1974, Emperor Selassie was clearly in the U.S. camp. In during the Cold War, Ethiopia was aligned with the U.S. It received a tremendous amount of military aid. The jet fighters that they were no longer using, like the F-5 and things like that. I mean, they were giving to Ethiopia to kind of counterbalance whatever gains the Soviet Union was making. And then you had the uprising, the overthrow, led by the forces that eventually organized around Mengistu. And the TPLF was formed in 1975. Mm-hmm. And the Tigray people are, according to data I've seen, only about 6% of the population of the country, but nevertheless, they appear to be very battle hardened fighters and warriors. And I know that there was a very deep famine in Ethiopia. That was one of the things that that was plaguing the Selassie government, the failure to deal with that. Was it the U.S. from the very beginning, as Ethiopia and Somalia switched sides during the Cold War? Somalia went from the Soviets to the U.S. Ethiopia went from the U.S. to the Soviets, and the regime was socialist or Marxist. Was it the U.S. that originally helped to fund and militarily support the TPLF in its fight against the military regime that came to power after Emperor Selassie was overthrown?
Well, the United States, as you've said, as much as the two superpowers, the then two superpowers, were making Africa a playing ground for their rivalry, the African countries were also taking advantage of this global competition and benefiting from it as well. So when Ethiopia gave access to the United States to a military base in the now Eritrea in the 1960s, that was used as a listening post in the region, just to tap on communication. So it became obsolete when India, the United States found a base, a much better base in the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean. So that relationship kind of deteriorated because U.S. didn't have any, you know, vested interest that will kind of justify its deeper involvement. But it was just keeping it at the diplomatic level and also doing things at the minimum. But at the same time, when the Somali invasion started becoming a reality, the Ethiopian government wanted to get more weapons from the Carter administration. And then Carter at the time was not sure about this military dictatorship that just came to power, so they refused to deliver. That led the Derg, or the military regime, to look eastward to the Soviet Union. And that's how the shift took place. And then that from there on into 1990, the CIA, it was some, a lot of recently declassified information also that is available to the general public. The CIA and Western countries were definitely helping the TPLF because the Derg was no friend of the United States. And of course, they were facilitating its fight against the military regime. And when the Cold War came to an end after Gorbachev, the USSR was in no position to continue to sustain the military government. So that kind of further weakened the military government and opened up the opportunity for the TPLF to come to Addis. But there has always been connections with the CIA and Western countries and the TPLF, even when they were liberation fighters. So right. The U.S., for example, and European countries during the famine didn't say anything when the TPLF was weaponizing food aid. They were selling those aid resources in the Sudan, and in return buying military equipment and so on and so forth from the Gulf countries and the markets in the Gulf countries. Mm-hmm. So there was a history of relationship, definitely. And that relationship has become full-fledged during the last three decades when the TPLF was in power, and then continued to even today. And we're seeing the fruits of that relationship today because these people are highly placed in this administration and they're behind this policy that we see now.
Exactly. Yeah. That's in order for people to understand why the United States, which, you know, claims to support democratically elected governments, but those are only democratically elected governments that they feel that they can control or that they can benefit from. You know, we've seen from the overthrow of Patrice Lumumba and Juan Bosch and many others. They don't really care. I mean, who gets elected? Hamas, for example, in Gaza. You can be democratically elected. That doesn't matter to them if they can't control you. But let me ask you this, I don't know if this is propaganda or if this is Western propaganda or what, but there are some sources that give the TPLF credit. I mean, they were as a minority ethnic group, they were able to form a coalition, as you said, the Ethiopian People's Revolutionary Democratic Front, which Abiy Ahmed was part of. He was an intelligence officer in the army, but they were given credit, for example, for reducing infant mortality and, you know, certain some economic development and the no major famines. And the GERD was started by the TPLF, correct?
The EPRDF, yes.
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 So, okay.
Here's what we have to give credit when it's due. The Meles Zenawi, the late Meles Zenawi, as a prime minister at the time, this vision, of course, of building the dam, and he made a very calculated decision, and this all project started during the Arab Spring, where Egypt was in no condition to, you know, intervene elsewhere. It was trying to deal with its own crisis from within. So there was also the Chinese were a new factor, so to speak, in the region, in the whole calculation. So the Chinese are the new power that are silently expanding into Africa, and they made opportunities available in terms of loans and other resources. So those conditions kind of created the opportunity for the government to advance its work on the dam. And yes, that clearly should go to the Prime Minister Melissa as well.
Okay.
But in terms of the economy growing, we always hear this World Bank figures that kind of justifies what they've been doing, giving loans to long-term loans for infrastructure as well as other funds, bilateral and multilateral funds being made available, because the TPLF was a darling of the West. At the time, it was also a partner of the United States in the post 9/11 environment, fighting Al-Shabaab in Somalia and other extremist groups in the region. And the U.S. was in return training the TPLF force, the APRD forces, and was not saying anything about its dictatorship, its iron fist rule, looting, and what have you. As you have mentioned, to your point, this is a government that is a yes man to the United States, and there was no problem as long as they continue to do so. But now here we have a prime minister who is Pan-Africanist, a prime minister who believed in regional integration and local solutions in the traditions of President Nyerere having a South-South relationship and basically empowering Africans. So that's contrary to what the U.S. practiced, which is a zero-sum game. And that didn't sit well with the United States.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because the TPLF-led government was induced by George Bush, Condoleezza Rice, and Jindai Frazier to invade Somalia in December 2006 to overthrow the Union of Islamic Courts, or the Islamic Courts Union, which had brought a measure of stability to the Mogadishu area, and Ethiopian troops invaded Somalia. And that, of course, they overthrew the more moderate Islamists, Union of Islamic Courts, and they got replaced by some real jihadists in Al-Shabaab. And Ethiopia, even though it's fighting, you know, this civil conflict against the TDF, the Tigray Defense Forces, Ethiopia still has troops in Somalia as part of the African Union mission. Why?
Well, I think this will not be lasting long, because the government of Ethiopia will lead those forces in Ethiopia. And then it may have been a matter, it will be a matter of time, I presume, before they have those forces out of there, because once again, the prime minister believes in self-reliance and serving, using African institutions and African methods to as a conflict resolution. So I hope that will lead to the withdrawal of Ethiopian forces from the area. But I don't have much information in terms of that conflict.
And yeah, it just didn't,
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I just, you know, one of the things that when we, the general, the commander, the central command leader for the U.S., the U.S. Armed Forces Central Command, which is based in Djibouti, said that if Ethiopia was to withdraw their troops from Somalia, then it would destabilize the region. Of course, this is probably just more of the rhetorical ethic, as Marimba Ani would say, in terms of what their real interest is. I don't want to ask all the questions. Does anybody else have anything you want to ask before I continue?
Yeah, sorry, I was on mute. Yeah, I wanted to go back to the statement that you mentioned about the TPLF and the $30 billion that was reported looted from the country. Mm-hmm. When we look at, for instance, the video that was leaked, where there was a meeting between several diplomats discussing support for the TPLF. Do you know if there are any connections between the looting of money coming from the government and various people around the world, like these diplomats, benefiting from that money being taken out of the country?
Of course. I mean, the TPLF and its leaders cannot do this by themselves. This is an illegal flow of money out of the country, and this is money appropriated for something else, and then of course you find a way to take it out. You have to have partners, international partners that are part of this looting. I mean, they're not going to do it by themselves. Even when you deposit such a huge amount of money in foreign banks, and those banks are also accomplices to this, it is customary that most autocratic African leaders, and they take out money, they loot, and then where do they keep it? They keep it in Western banks. And sometimes it disappears over there as well.
Yeah, it seems to be a repeated formula that we see, as Brother Mark Roo stated, when the U.S. or other Western countries can't exploit a particular leader or can't make that leader exploit his own people, then they want that person out of power. And one of the comments that was mentioned by one of the women on the video was that Abe is not listening. So it seems as though there must be some type of financial disconnection where they're losing money by him being in power.
Yes, the way the American political system, I'm sure you know that works, the individuals working in the public sector and the government, there's this revolving door. They can go out and become consultants. They can go out and become lobbyists and PR agents. So you can imagine how this network can be expanded to include all of those people that have been in government. And one of the things that the TPLF doing now, as we speak, is that hiring these top-rated lobbying firms that are just lobbying the administration as well as the House and the Senate, and selling this narrative, using the media even to advance this agenda, which is of course a marriage of convenience with the U.S. with the current administration, so to speak, with the TPLF and the current administration.
Right. Hmm. So, Brother Fasil, so Abiy Ahmed formed the Prosperity Party, and he invited. Before I do that, let me go back to something you said about how the ethnic identities that the TPLF created were the current states that regions or regional governments that we have in the country now. You know, Afar, Amhara, the various regions there. Did the TPLF create those, or were they already there?
No, Ethiopia before was organized even during the emperor and the dirt. It was not organized based on ethnicity. It was rather geographic regions. Like during the emperor's time, there was 14 geographic regions called Begemeder, Wadlo, Harar, Bale, Goba, so on and so forth. These were regions that was based on geography. So when the TPLF came, used ethnicity as a principal way of dividing the country and putting people within their ethnic enclave, so to speak, like the Oromo has its own regions. The southern people have their own region. And then the other regions, the Afar, Somali, and the Tigray, respectively, have their own regions, and then the Amhara. So that is something that was introduced by the TPLF with very negative implications, because those states are not, and also the constitution made the states more powerful than the central. The central was always weak, and those states have their own power. And it also, in the last 30 years, created a generation of Ethiopians politically socialized by ethnicity, especially in those remote areas. But compared to urban areas, you know, you usually get this eclectic kind of environment where people interact and get exposed to different cultures. But if you go to the remote areas, especially in those self-governing ethnic states, you have this animosity based on ethnicity. And in the absence of economic opportunity in the countries like Ethiopia, the people go to their primordial instinct, especially if you develop and cultivate that as an organizing principle. It's very, very easy to create conflicts and animosities between groups.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, and you know, that's the European model. I mean, that's been the European model, particularly in Africa, you know, with, you know, Hutus, Tutsis. I mean, we, you know, we see this over and over and over and over again, and we keep falling into the trap when the model on upon which African civilization was advanced was, you know, to submerge ethnic differences and become one people. And there's a reason why Ethiopia has been able to stand as an independent country for so long, and it's because people had an Ethiopian identity. I mean, these, you know, these wars, you know, against the defeating the Italians and, you know, fighting Mussolini. And I mean, so, you know, this is following the model. And it also seems that when Abiy Ahmed formed the Prosperity Party to bring all of these groups together, the TPLF rejected, you know, that opportunity to join and become part of a unified government. And, you know, that seems to me to be a situation where you have, you know, these white supremacist wizards, you know, behind the curtain, you know, pulling strings to make sure that there's some divisions, because we don't want this country to become an economic powerhouse. And if the Grand Renaissance Dam is developed and we get this, you know, electricity, then, you know, the country's on the way to self-reliance. I mean, is that how you how do you see their rejection of the offer to become part of the Prosperity Party?
Well, the way they see things is kind of strange. They think that any government that doesn't include them as a major partner is not going to be accepted by them. And of course, they know that they can take advantage of the interest of external forces in all of this and embolden themselves, get resources from other countries that don't like these developments in Ethiopia, and they use that as an opportunity to come to power. That's their motive. And also, when you look at it, the ethnic divisions created by them have done so much damage in the country to the extent that now they're using that narrative even to mobilize the Tigray population and saying that, hey, the Amara, hey, the Oromo, all, especially the Amara, which is very sad and unfortunate, is going to come and attack you. But both the majority of the population in Tigray and Amara area are very poor, downtrodden, and haven't benefited from all of this, and they just become victims. So I bet the elites are always the ones that are taking advantage of this. If you look at the last 30 years, the TPLF, for example, organized the military in such a way that the top-ranking leadership, 80% of them were from Tigray. 60% of the middle-level leadership was from Tigray. And that also was the same in the government civil services. They also created a TPLF-based economic elite system where they have their own trusted confidants get loans and preferential treatment so that they can be enriching themselves. And then on top of that, they start sending their kids to overseas, pay for their education, and raise the next generation of TPLF. This was a well-planned, well-thought-over effort that was meant to be perpetuating the leadership of the TPLF for a century to come.
Exactly. Now, let's I'm going to move to this, the incident on November 4th, 2020, in McKinley. And I tell you, when I read the history of this attack on the Ethiopian Defense Force outpost, there in the Tigray region, I couldn't help but think about the attack on the Libyan defense operation in Benghazi in 2011. It seemed to be the same game plan. And it almost seemed like a sucker punch or a trap because, you know, I attack you. How do you respond? And Abiy Ahmed's response, was militarily. Did he attempt any kind of negotiation or anything at that point? Because it just seems to me, when I compare the history there, what happened in Libya in 2011, what happened in Ethiopia in 2020, and you got two leaders on the African continent that they want to get rid of, then start something and see how they respond, and then when they respond, now we have the opportunity to try to demonize and vilify them, to turn the population against them. But of course, it hasn't worked. But I'm not in that position. I'm just saying, just looking at the history, it seemed to me to be a sucker punch to say, okay, I'm gonna hit you. Let's see if you hit me back.
Well, before the start of the war or even this preemptive attack, the Abiy government made quite very interesting and well-meant effort to pacify the situation, because the day one when the reform took place, they went back to their state, the Tigray state, and start regrouping and trying to strengthen their position. But in the meantime, he was sending delegations after delegations. There were a group of mothers that were there to plead with the leadership to just resolve this peacefully and then move on with the other important things that needed to be done to take the country to the next step. You have religious leaders that were sent down there to beg with them, make their case and plead their case with the leadership. There were athletes and celebrities from different sectors that went down there, businessmen, to no avail. And then they were preparing for this day. This military base, the soldiers there were very much immersed into the community. They were helping with harvesting. They were helping with the COVID pandemic. They were part of the community. But as they boasted on national TV, and this is also on YouTube, they said they preemptively attacked these forces, and they were prepared to do that. So that, of course, presented the opportunity for outside forces to jump on and try to make the conflict a sort of a platform to position themselves and benefiting from the new power arrangement.
Right. Now, by the end of November 2020, of course, you have the Eritrea getting involved militarily. It appeared that the insurgency had been repelled. TPLF or TDF of the forces there were on the run, and then suddenly, over the next several months, they make a comeback. Mm-hmm. And you could see that they had it wasn't just about Tigray, because if it's just about Tigray, then why do you invade Afar and Amhara? I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. obviously there's some designs there. There was even an attack that actually came through Sudan, attempting to do some damage to the dam, to the Grand Renaissance Dam. So obviously there's it was not just about protecting their region.
No, not at all, because they were emboldened, resuscitated by the United States and the Western countries to just go out and further put pressure and the hope that the government will be capitulating. And then that didn't happen. All the good gestures were taken as a weakness. And then you have the, under the guise of humanitarian aid, a lot of logistical help was given to the TPLF. They had satellite communication radios. They have satellite imageries, pictures, and other resources being delivered under the name of humanitarian aid. At one point, there were about 800 UN trucks that never came back after delivering the tour. And then later on, we seeing them resurfacing, transporting TPLF troops to the Amhara and Afar regions. And then the tragedy of this is that they went into these regions and created havoc. They destructed infrastructure. They committed crime against humanity. Right now, we start hearing reports from those areas that have been, that the enemy had been pushed out. We're hearing reports of rape, gang rape of children, elderly women, and then also destroying infrastructure, medical facilities, schools. The damage that they have done is going to take quite a lot of resources and time to build it back to what it was before the start of the conflict. And then you have the crime against the Amharas, crime against the Afar people, innocent civilians just being killed for just for the sake of revenge. And the international bodies that are said to be investigating such atrocities are just saying, no, they're not, you know, they're not even talking about this. So yeah, they rather are trying to create a misinformation, turning this story about where in Maykadra, in the part of Tigray, where more than 100 Amhara and other ethnic groups were killed just because of their ethnic background. And then they started creating the impression that this was not a war against ethnic groups or genocide, but rather conflict between two parties. I don't know if you know Jeff Pierce, the journalist, went out there and did a wonderful documentary talking firsthand to the people that have been victimized. And the sad part is when the TPLF, after the ceasefire, was using child soldiers, and the New York Times has a full page, front page story about how this courageous TPLF is fighting back with its supporters, so on and so forth. But these are kids, 14 and 15, being drafted into military, forcefully taken from their families in some cases, because you have to contribute, based on the interview done with the prisoners of war from Tigray, they were forced to contribute at least 1% from the family to this fight. And they were weaponizing food aid as they have done it in the past when they were rebel forces. They're not giving out food aid to people that are not partnering with them or helping them with their effort to facilitate and continue this conflict.
Well, you know, you can clearly see the favoritism shown by the U.S. when they, Biden, the empire politician. I mean, this guy's he's a career empire politician, supported every war that the United States has ever even thought of. And of course, he was Obama's, vice president, as Obama went about, rampaging through the world with his drones. He gave his UN speech and called out, the Ethiopian government, and then applied sanctions to people within the Ethiopian government and also Eritrean military and government, but nothing against the TPLF, when even the UN had to admit that, just like in any war, just the bombing of Dresden, during World War II, just like any war, you know, you're going to have, civilian casualties, but, this whole, child soldier thing, they have Charles Taylor. They charged him with war crimes and put him on trial in The Hague for this. But if it's someone they support, like the Shah of Iran or Marcos, in the Philippines, or, Somoza in Nicaragua, the Pinochet in Chile, if it's their dictator, then it's all well and good, and that's what we see happening. As you said, Abiy Ahmed declared a ceasefire to give the farmers an opportunity to harvest their crops during the planting season, and the TPLF took that as an opportunity. Now, beginning at the end of October and the end of October and the 1st of November, if we would have believed Western media, Addis Ababa would have already fallen to the TPLF by now, because you know they were just blowing up so-called success stories in Desi and Kombolcha, and then the OLA in Khamis. And Abiy Ahmed did something that we can't imagine Barack Obama or anyone, Donald Trump, he went to the battlefield. He went to the front lines to inspire his army. And it appears now that the TPLF has been driven completely out of Afar, and they're on the run in Amhara. So do you think this now gives the opposing sides an opportunity to reach some kind of agreement? Because at the end of the day, you know, we are all African people, but we know that there are some African people that you have to fight and you have to defeat. You know what I mean? If, you know, Malcolm X had been able to organize and form his African-American brigades and send them to the Congo to link up with Che Guevara, we may have gotten rid of Mobutu. So how do you see the current situation, you know, on the ground right now?
Well, I mean, the government forces have the upper hand, obviously. Abiy's decision to go to the front and lead all of this has created another level of galvanization, bolstering the Ethiopian forces, and then leading to a progressive outcome at the battlefront. But at the same time, no one wants to see another single person die. You know, this has to stop. This has to come to an end. But this will probably be possible if outside external forces are not adding fuel to the fire. This would have been over way back then, because at some point the government was so much in control of a lot of areas and was containing them in that specific area. And most of the leadership were taken out, and then the people were of the view that this is going to come to an end. And then next thing you know, those external forces being involved and then trying to revamp and perpetuate this conflict, which is a tragedy, because people, poor people that have nothing to do with this whole notion of ethnicity or anything that for that matter, are dying. And it's a war that is waged on the Ethiopian people, on its legitimate government. The Ethiopian people never wanted this war. It's very unfortunate, but it will hopefully come to an end, and then we'll move to the next chapter.
Thank you very much, Relamos or Gullah Jack. Anybody have any closing questions for our good brother?
Briefly, how can we support the government here in the United States?
That's a very important question that I almost overlooked. You know, the African Americans have a history of supporting the continent. If you remember the Italian War, most African Americans were registering to go back and fight, even the State Department was refusing to issue passports to them. You have the Brown Condor that was flying, fighting plane for the Emperor in the 1930s that went from Chicago. Ethiopia has also played a significant role in the liberation movement of African countries. Mandela was trained in Ethiopia. Zimbabwe got 10,000 troops trained and well-equipped, contributing to the liberation fight of most African countries. And there's a long history of relationship with African Americans and Ethiopia. So Ethiopia is important, not only for Ethiopians, but for the continent, as well as the African diaspora and the Pan-Africanism movement. Right now, other African countries are now understanding or kind of getting a wake-up call in terms of the need to resist this pressure from external forces. We've seen how popular uprisings in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger saying no more, hashtag no more, the movement that we started about this war. So the progressive people like you can also help in setting the record straight by informing the African-American community. Most of the time, Americans are not very interested in foreign policy until it's a hot button issue. But this is more than a hot button issue. It has implications beyond the region. So I urge all brothers and sisters to be part of this movement to create a platform for the truth to be told and eventually putting pressure on the government to stop it from supporting and doing such a heinous crime.
Indeed, indeed. I did forget to ask you. I'm glad Gullah Jack asked that question, because I mean to ask you about the No More movement, which has been banned from Twitter, because of their pro the democratically elected government of Ethiopia. They tell us to be democratic and whatnot, but and as you said, the youth, Mali, Burkina Faso, Guinea, other countries, we see that the median age on the African continent is 18. So there's a lot of potential there. I would hope that the No More movement, which was organized to support the Ethiopian government, and that is now supporting other events. Perhaps this could become the organization, right, that reinvigorates the African world, put us, back on the track that was initiated, by the honorable, Marcus Mosiah Garvey and his two Amys, Ashwood and Jocks, and of course Omawale Malcolm X's attempt to form the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which was developing chapters, in Europe, for example. He was planning to go to the Caribbean. So just tell us, what is your perspective on the potential of the No More movement?
Well, it has a huge potential. Actually, yesterday, a friend of mine told me that now they're planning a protest under the No More movement in a few countries, about close to 20 cities in Africa. And also, after organizing this protest, they're also planning to go to the U.S. Embassy and submit their letter of opposition to this coordinated pressure on the Ethiopian government. So given social media, the transnational nature of social media, most African countries, especially the youth, are very much aware of these developments, and they're working together to create something to give fuel to the movement. But of course, as you have mentioned, those mainstream social media is preventing this movement to be on their platform. So this is also interesting, because there's this movement in Africa to create a different platform, social media platform, that Africans can control. So yeah, in that aspect, it is gaining momentum, surely, but slowly, and I hope it will be fully activated to the extent that it will create and become a game changer.
Asante Sana. Any closing thoughts or words of wisdom, as Baba Reggie would say, from the panel?
I just want to say Amasaganalo to Brother Fasil. Thank you for coming on. We definitely need more brothers like yourself to present this valuable information, because we are limited with the true information that we get from the media outlets here in the West. So it's good to get a true perspective of what's happening in Ethiopia on the ground there. So definitely, thank you, Brother Fasil.
I can't.
Indeed.
I'm sorry. I can't emphasize enough how this is important to me and other people from the continent, and even African Americans and other progressive, freedom-loving people. Having such a platform is invaluable. It's priceless, because the mainstream media has blocked out all the conversation that is challenging the system. As early as last week, the Ethiopian government made an announcement for students, pleading with the students to come out and collect with the harvest that is still sitting in the field. Mm. Guess how the BBC reported this, that the government is calling young people to go to war. That's how it was reported. That's the BBC. So this platform is critical to our movement, critical to what we're doing. And I really appreciate that and hope to be back on this platform again.
Most definitely, my brother, you will definitely be invited back as, you know, as things develop, and hopefully, you know, this conflict can come to an end. African people can unify, and, you know, we can get the dam completed and, you know, deal with the Arabs, you know, on another level and go forward from there. Appreciate it very much, you being here. Go ahead, Brother Amos. Tell people where they can find this, the information that we have.
If you're listening on Facebook or YouTube, give us a like this video and share it with everyone so that this information can definitely get out there. Subscribe, and you can listen to this podcast on anywhere, any platform you get your podcast. Until next time, brothers and sisters, we say a BB for Hodie for African liberation.
BB for Hodie.
BB for Hodie.
I'm a sacanalo.
Power or the lack of power. I want to repeat this. Power or the lack of power. If your education in this institution is not about gaining real power, not jobs, because your jobs do not represent power. Not getting elected, that does not represent power either. Buying your houses and fine clothes does not represent power. If it is not about real power, you are being miseducated and misled, and you will die educated and misled. If your study of Black history is merely an exercise in feeling good about yourself, then you will die feeling good. The study of history then must be more than the pumping up of your self-esteem and the pumping up of your pride. Those things are important, but ultimately, those things are not the means by which we will save ourselves as people in this world.